if-then propositions, with the then part always the same. Better get busy. See someone you want to become? Better get busy. Want to catch up with a desirable group? Better get busy. Barg and his colleagues have performed a number of similarly magical-seeming experiments where they use tiny environmental cues, such as inspirational words hidden in a crossword puzzle, to manipulate motivation and effort among unknowing experimental subjects. They possess piles of supportive data to explain why this is so effective. For instance, the fact that the unconscious mind is able to process 11 million pieces of information per second, while the conscious mind can manage a mere 40. This disproportion points to the efficiency and necessity of relegating mental activities to the unconscious, and helps us to understand why appeals to the unconscious can be so effective. One of the better demonstrations of the power of primal cues, however, came about by accident. In the 1970s, a clinical psychologist from Long Island named Martin Eisenstadt tracked the parental histories of every person who was eminent enough to have earned a half-page-long entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica, a roster of 573 subjects, spanning Homer to John F. Kennedy, a rich mix of writers, scientists, political leaders, composers, soldiers, philosophers, and explorers. Eisenstadt wasn't interested in motivation per se. In fact, he was testing a theory he developed relating genius and psychosis to the loss of a parent or parents at an early age. But he wound up constructing an elegant demonstration of the relationship between motivation and primal cues. Within this accomplished group, the parental loss club turned out to be standing room only. Political leaders who lost a parent at an early age include Julius Caesar, father, 15, Napoleon, father, 15, 15 British prime ministers, Washington, father, 11, Jefferson, father, 14, Lincoln, mother, 9, Lenin, father, 15, Hitler, father, 13, Gandhi, father, 15, Stalin, father, 11, and we reflexively paste in Bill Clinton, father, infant. Scientists and artists on the list include Copernicus, father, 10, Newton, father, before birth, Darwin, mother, 8, Dante, mother, 6, Michelangelo, mother, 6, Bach, mother and father, 9, Handel, father, 11, Dostoevsky, mother, 15, Keats, father, 8, mother, 14, Byron, father, 3, Emerson, father, 8, Melville, father, 12, Wordsworth, mother, 7, father, 13, Nietzsche, father, 4, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne Bronte, mother at 5, 3, and 1, respectively, Wolfe, mother, 13, and Twain, father, 11. On average, the eminent group lost their first parent at an average age of 13.9, compared with 19.6 for a control group. All in all, it's a list deep and broad enough to justify the question posed by a 1978 French study. Do orphans rule the world? The genetic explanation for world-class achievement is useless in this case, because the people on this list are linked by shared life events that have nothing to do with chromosomes. But when we look at parental loss as a signal hitting a motivational trigger, the connection becomes clearer. Losing a parent is a primal cue. You are not safe. You don't have to be a psychologist to appreciate the massive outpouring of energy that can be created by a lack of safety. Nor do you have to be a Darwinian theorist to appreciate how such a response might have evolved. This signal can alter the child's relationship to the world, redefine his identity, and energize and orient his mind to address the dangers and possibilities of life. A response Eisenstadt summed up as a springboard of immense compensatory energy. Or as Dean Keith Simonton wrote of parental loss in Origins of Genius, such adverse events nurture the development of a personality robust enough to overcome the many obstacles and frustrations standing in the path of achievement. If we take it one step further and presume that many of the world-class scientists, artists, and writers on Eisenstadt's list accomplished the requisite 10,000 hours of deep practice, the mechanism of their ignition becomes more apparent. Losing a parent at a young age was not what gave them talent. Rather, it was the primal cue, "You are not safe," that by tripping the ancient self-preserving evolutionary switch provided energy for their efforts, so that they built their various talents over the course of years, step by step, rap by rap. Seen this way, the superstars on Eisenstadt's list are not uniquely gifted exceptions, but rather the logical extensions of the same universal principles that govern all of us. 1. Talent requires deep practice. 2. Deep practice requires vast amounts of energy. 3. Primal cues trigger huge outpourings of energy. And as George Bartsokas might point out, the eminent people on average receive this signal as young teens, during the brain's key development period, in which information processing pathways are particularly receptive to myelin. The second example of ignition originates a little closer to home. In our family of six, our daughter Zoe is the youngest, and for her age, 7, the speediest. Her foot speed seems perfectly natural, and yet, since I started learning about myelin, I began to wonder how much of Zoe's foot speed is innate, and how much of it stems from the combination of practice and motivation she gets from being the youngest. I undertook a highly unscientific survey of my friends' children. The pattern seemed to hold. The youngest kids were frequently the fastest runners. It became more interesting when I broadened the sample group slightly. Here are the birth order ranks of the world record progression in the 100-meter dash, with the most recently set world record first, the previous world record second, and so on. Usain Bolt, second of three children. Asafa Powell, sixth of six. Justin Gatlin, fourth of four. Maurice Green, fourth of four. Donovan Bailey, third of three. Leroy Burrell, fourth of five. Carl Lewis, third of four. Calvin Smith, sixth of eight. While the sample size is small, the pattern is clear. Of the eight men on the list, Burrell and Lewis appear twice. None of them were firstborn, and only one was born in the first half of his family's birth order. In all, history's fastest runners were born on average fourth in families of 4.6 children. We find a similar result with the top 10 all-time NFL running backs in rushing yardage, who score an average birth rank of 3.2 out of families of 4.4 kids. This pattern strikes us as surprising because speed looks like a gift. It feels like a gift. And yet this pattern suggests that speed is not purely a gift, but a skill that grows through deep practice and that is ignited by primal cues. In this case, the cue is, "You're behind, keep up." We can safely imagine that in most families, this signal is sent and received hundreds, if not thousands of times over the childhood years, sent by older, bigger kids to smaller, younger ones, who respond with levels of effort and intensity that those older children, who shared the same genetic inheritance, never had the opportunity to experience. And recall that myelin is all about impulse speed. The more you have, the faster your muscles can fire, a particularly handy feature for sprinters. This is not to say that being born late into a big family automatically makes someone fast, any more than having a parent die early in life automatically makes one Prime Minister of England. But it does say that being fast, like any talent, involves a confluence of factors that go beyond genes and that are directly related to the intense subconscious reaction to motivational signals that provide the energy to practice deeply and thus grow myelin. As with McPherson's musicians, the South Korean golfers, and the Russian tennis players, Zoe and the rest of the people on this list are talented not only because they were born that way, but also because at some mysterious point they caught on to a powerful idea, an idea that originated in the flow of images and signals around them, those tiny sparks that set them alight. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. Oh, lucky me! Safety and future belonging are two powerful primal cues, but they are not the only ones useful for igniting talent. In the early 1980s, a young violin teacher named Roberta Savaris decided to bring classical music to three Harlem public elementary schools. The problem was there were far more students than violins. To solve this problem, as well as to underscore her belief that every child is capable of learning to play the violin, Savaris decided to hold a lottery. The first class, made up of the lottery winners, made surprisingly fast progress. So did the second and the third. The program thrived and came to be called the Opus 118 Harlem Center for Strings. Savaris and her students have performed at Carnegie Hall, at Lincoln Center, and on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Their success inspired a documentary film, Small Wonders, and a 1999 Hollywood movie called Music of the Heart. Naturally, other public schools attempted to develop their own versions of Opus 118, among them two public schools, Wadley Secondary School of the Performing and Visual Arts in Harlem and PS 233 in Flatbush, Brooklyn. The two violin programs make a useful comparison, because they started at about the same time and happened to be taught by the same instructor, David Burnett of the Harlem School for the Arts. They also make a useful comparison because one of the programs succeeded and the other did not. To predict beforehand which program would succeed might seem easy. Wadley enjoyed numerous advantages over PS 233, including an arts-focused curriculum, parents who had, by enrolling their child, expressed a belief in the value of art education, students who presumably had a real interest in music, a brand new auditorium, and a budget that permitted the school to purchase violins for every student who wanted to play. PS 233, on the other hand, was an archetypal urban public school. The students had no apparent inclination toward violins or arts in general. What's more, the foundation that funded the program could afford only 50 violins, most of which were too small, forcing Burnett to hold an Opus 118-style lottery to determine who got in. As the programs got underway, the result seemed preordained. Wadley would succeed, and PS 233 would fail. And yet, a year later, it was the Wadley program that was sputtering, and the PS 233 program that was going strong. The Wadley program was beset with discipline problems, and the PS 233 group was well-behaved. The Wadley students teased the good players and discouraged them from continuing, and the PS 233 students did their practice and got steadily better. When asked to explain, Burnett can only say that the Wadley program just failed to take off. Why? I believe part of the answer can be found in Small Wonders, the documentary film on Opus 118. Early in the film, its makers capture the scene of Savaris visiting a first-grade class to perform music and tell them about a group to which they might someday belong, if they are fortunate. As she explains how the lottery works, the kids bounce up and down nervously. They clamor for applications to take home to their parents. A week or two goes by. A sense of anticipation builds. Savaris returns to the classroom carrying a stack of winning applications. Then, to rapt silence, she proceeds to announce the winners' names. On hearing their names, the kids react as if they'd just received an electric shock. They dance, they scream, they flail their arms in joy. They race home to tell their parents the thrilling news. They won! They don't know the A string from the A train, but it doesn't matter in the least. Like the long-term commitment group in Gary McPherson's study, they are ignited, and it makes all the difference. If talent is a gift sprinkled randomly through the world's children, we would naturally expect Wadley's program to be the one to succeed. But if talent is a process that can be ignited by primal cues, then the reason for PS 233's success is clear. The genetic potential in both schools was the same. The teaching was the same. The difference was the students at Wadley received the motivational equivalent of a gentle nudge, while the PS 233 students were ignited by primal cues of scarcity and belonging. In each case, the kids reacted the same way any of us would. Let's return to the question that started the previous section. Why was Tom Sawyer able to persuade Ben to help him whitewash the fence? The answer is that Tom flung primal cues at Ben with the speed and accuracy of a circus knife thrower. In the space of a few sentences, he managed to hit bullseyes of exclusivity. All I know is it suits Tom Sawyer. I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000. And scarcity. Does a boy get a chance to whitewash a fence every day? Aunt Paula is awful particular about this fence. His gestures and body language echoed the same messages. He contemplated the boy a bit, and stepped back to note the effect, added a touch here and there, criticized the effect again, as though engaged in a work of the greatest importance. If Tom had only sent one or two of these signals, or if they'd been spaced over the course of a leisurely hour, his cues would have had no effect. Ben's trigger would have remained untouched. But the rich combination of cues, peppering Ben's ignition switch one after another, succeeded in cracking open his vault of motivational energy. We usually regard this passage as an example of a sophisticated con job, clever Tom Sawyer hoodwinking gullible yokels into doing unsavory work. Primal cue psychology allows us to see it in a slightly different way. Tom's signals worked not because Ben was some thoughtless dupe. Indeed, a thoughtless dupe would have shrugged and trudged on to the swimming hole. Tom's signals work because Ben, as Twain wrote, watched every move and was absorbed. Ben's was the response of an attentive kid who saw in Tom Sawyer's work something attractive and who was ignited, not unlike the response of attentive kids in South Korea or Russia, or of Zoe watching her siblings run ahead of her. Ignition doesn't follow normal rules because it's not designed to follow rules. It's designed only to work, to give us energy for whatever tasks we choose. Or, as we'll see next, for whatever tasks fate chooses for us. Chapter 6. The Curaçao Experiment. The whole island jumped. Lucio Antonia, Curaçao Little League parent. The Earthquake. Every August, at the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, a team of 11 and 12-year-old boys from Curaçao stages a vivid reenactment of David versus Goliath. Actually, it's more like David versus 15 Goliaths. In a 16-team tournament frequently dominated by hulking, flame-throwing man-boys, this wiry, undersized team of nobodies from a tiny, remote Caribbean island somehow keeps succeeding. In a worldwide competition where qualifying two consecutive years is considered a remarkable achievement, the Curaçao boys have made it to the semifinals 6 times in the last 8 years, winning the title in 2004 and finishing second in 2005. As ESPN announcers have christened it, Curaçao is the little island that could. Curaçao's accomplishments are even more impressive for the fact that compared with the teams they beat, they have precious few facilities. There are only 2 Little League regulation fields on the entire island, and 1 batting cage constructed of tattered fishnet. What's more, the Curaçao baseball season lasts but 5 months. Practices are held 3 times a week, and games are on weekends, a schedule that contrasts markedly with a year-round approach of other places like Venezuela. When I saw them in Williamsport at the 2007 series, the younger members of the Curaçao team were bemused by the spectacle of the Japanese team doing drills before breakfast. "Why do they do that?" one player asked me, mystified. The most compelling element of this underdog story, however, is that Curaçao's success can be traced to a single moment of ignition. Actually, 2 moments, lasting approximately 3 seconds each. They both happened at Yankee Stadium on October 20, 1996, in the opening game of the World Series between the Atlanta Braves and the New York Yankees. Like many moments of ignition, this one fascinates because it hangs so heavily on chance, literally on the postage stamp size area of contact created when a round bat meets a round ball. 1/8 of an inch either way, and if history is any guide, the Curaçao phenomenon would not have happened. The situation at Yankee Stadium seemed unpromising. No score, top of the 2nd inning, Braves runner on first base. An unknown 19-year-old Curaçaoan rookie named Andrew Jones stood at the plate waggling his bat, a Mona Lisa smile creasing his chubby face. Jones had started his season at the single-A level of the minor leagues. He'd been promoted to the majors only 2 months earlier. The Yankee ace, Andy Pettit, stared him down with a somber expression of a bullfighter. Pettit was only a few years older, but in this image the narrative was clear. Canny veteran versus naive rookie. Pettit worked the count full, then unleashed his best pitch, a nasty slider. The intention was to induce the rookie to do what most rookies do in that situation, get fooled, reach for the pitch, and ground it into a double play. But Jones was not most rookies. Jones recognized the spin on the slider and slammed the pitch 10 rows into the left field seats. 56,000 Yankee fans went quiet as Jones, his smile broadening, sped around the bases. It was an extraordinary feat, one that couldn't possibly be outdone. But then, it was. The very next inning, Jones walked up to the plate and on another full-count pitch, smashed an even more towering drive into the left field seats. The television announcers gasped and stammered as if solving a difficult mathematical equation. World Series plus Yankee Stadium plus unknown teenager equals 2 consecutive home runs? A nuclear burst of media attention followed, hailing Jones's natural-born talent, comparing him to Clemente, Mantle, and Da Vinci, marveling at the unearthly God-given quickness of his wrists. In fact, that quickness was no gift from above. Jones had been swinging a bat since the age of 2, coached by his father Henry. When he was older, Andrew swung a sledgehammer 3 times a week, rolling his wrists in a circle to build hand speed and strength. As Jones later put it, "My dad taught me baseball stuff. To work my ass off." The Hall of Fame in Cooperstown requested Jones's bat. Agence France-Presse called it the greatest debut in World Series history. Like a shockwave, Jones's historic feat flashed on screens around the world. But all that was nothing compared to the blast that rocked Jones's hometown of Willemstad. Curaçao's Little League founder, Frank Curiel, remembers the sound he heard when Jones hit the home runs. It was very, very loud. Firecrackers, yelling, everyone shouting, everyone waking up. A few weeks later, at Little League signups, the first aftershock showed up in the form of 400 new kids. Their motivation was perhaps all the stronger since they knew that Jones hadn't even been one of the best players on the island. As a 15-year-old, he had switched from third base to outfield, so he could get more playing time. After all, if he could do it... Even with this extraordinary infusion of enthusiastic recruits, Curaçao's talent bloom took time to develop, just as it did for Russia's tennis players and South Korea's golfers. After all, myelin doesn't grow overnight. Not until 2001, 5 years after Jones's home runs, did a team of Curaçao Little Leaguers arrive at Howard J. LeMaitre Stadium in Williamsport to compete in the Little League World Series. LLWS. Tournament officials considered it a fluke appearance. After all, Curaçao had qualified for the LLWS only once before, back in 1980. And as LLWS press officer Christopher Downs put it, Curaçao had always been pretty miserable. But the Curaçao team, half of which had originally signed up after Jones's homers, surprised observers by reaching the international final. Though they lost 2-1 to the eventual champions from Tokyo, they had succeeded at establishing the Giant Slayer plotline that they faithfully followed ever since. As is true of any talent hotbed, Curaçao's success wasn't caused solely by the primal signals that created ignition. The matrix of other causes includes disciplined culture, top-notch coaching, supportive parents, national pride, the love of the game, and, of course, a wealth of deep practice. From what I saw, Jones's style of training is the rule, not the exception. Curaçao is interesting for another reason. A few dozen miles west lies the island of Aruba. Aruba is like Curaçao in almost every measurable way. They have the same population, the same language, the same Dutch-influenced culture, and the same love of baseball. Even their flags are nearly carbon copies. Aruba fields quality Little League teams that, until recently, competed well against Curaçao's. To top it off, Aruba had even produced a Major League player who was, for a moment in 1996, regarded as a better prospect than Andrew Jones. That star's name was Sidney Ponson, and his early success with the Baltimore Orioles, like that of Jones with the Braves, had fueled Aruban Little League with a fresh spark of excitement and participation. The two islands were twins, right down to the motivational spark. And yet Curaçao ignited, while Aruba did not. Why? Part of the answer is that Curaçao, like other talent hotbeds, has found a way to do a very important and tricky thing, to keep the motivational fire lit. It's one thing to persuade Scrooge to crack open his vault. It's another to persuade him to splurge on Christmas geese day after day, year after year. Curaçao forms, quite by accident, a natural case study on the science and practice of sustained ignition. The Sistine Chapel Effect. Ignition, in Curaçao, or anywhere, doesn't come from guarantees. For every breakthrough performance that ignites a talent bloom, there are dozens of breakthroughs that peter out. Germany's Boris Becker won Wimbledon at 17, but inspired no Teutonic wave of players. Miguel Cervantes dazzled the Shakespearean era with Don Quixote, but had little apparent effect on his native Spain. The painter Edvard Munch, The Scream, remains the sole member of that oxymoronic group, Norwegian Expressionists. These cases and others like them lead us to an interesting question. Why do breakthrough performances sometimes ignite talent blooms and sometimes not? The answer is that talent hotbeds possess more than a single primal cue. They contain complex collections of signals, people, images, and ideas that keep ignition going for the weeks, months, and years that skill growing requires. Talent hotbeds are to primal cues what Las Vegas is to neon signs, flashing with the kind of signals that keep motivation burning. Consider the sights that a young Michelangelo would have encountered in a single afternoon in Florence. In a half-hour stroll, he could have visited the workshops of a dozen great artists. These were not quiet studios. To the contrary, they were beehives overseen by a master and a hustling team of journeymen and apprentices, competing for commissions, filling orders, making plans, testing new techniques. He could have encountered Donatello's St. Mark statue, Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise, the works of painters from his boss Ghirlandaio through Masaccio, Giotto, and Cimabue, the greatest hits of architecture, painting, and sculpture. All of them were concentrated within a few blocks. All of them were simply part of the landscape of everyday life, and all flashed signals that added up to one energizing message. Better get busy. Or consider the scene at the Mermaid Tavern in London during Shakespeare's day. There, across the river from the Globe Theatre, the major writers of the day, Marlowe, Jonson, Donne, Raleigh, gathered to talk shop and match wits. Or consider the Academy and Lyceum of Athens, where Plato, Aristotle, and the rest taught, argued, and learned. Or consider the thronging environs of Sao Paulo, where, walking around one afternoon, I attempted to keep track of the number of signals about soccer I spotted. A TV highlight, a billboard, an overheard conversation, 4 futsal pickup games, 5 kids juggling balls down the street. I lost track somewhere after 50. Frank Curiel Field in Willemstad, Curaçao, doesn't look much like ancient Greece. It has dented aluminum bleachers, a snack shack behind home plate, and on the day I've come to watch practice, a sprinkling of parents sipping Cokes and shooting the breeze. The teams are warming up for a game, playing catch, kidding around. It looks like a slightly more decrepit version of every small-town baseball field you've ever seen. But that's only camouflage. In fact, when I examine it more closely, I see that it's cluttered with primal cues. The first cue stands 6 feet tall, wears an immaculate floral shirt, and carries a small red cup filled with Dewars and Red Bull. This is Frank Curiel himself, the 68-year-old league founder, groundskeeper, scheduler, seller of the Cokes, controller of the lights, keeper of the trophies, and benign ruler of this tiny kingdom. He is a tropical Don Corleone, a resemblance underlined by his hoarse whisper of a voice. Curiel shows me around his field, outlining his story as we walk, how he brought Little League to the island 45 years ago, how he saw the great Clemente play in Puerto Rico, how he decided to start a league, how he went to Springfield College in Massachusetts to learn physical education, how he got a job with Curaçao Sports and Recreation Agency, how he would drive around Willemstad's neighborhoods to recruit kids to play. They played, he says, then their kids played, and now their kids play. I see them all. In describing devoted organizers like Curiel, it's customary to state that they live at the field. With Curiel, this is no figure of speech. His home is a 10-by-12-foot tin-roofed shack that sits atop steel pilings just behind home plate. A swatch of chain-link fence prevents foul balls from flying into his soup. The room is a riotous flood of trophies, plaques, equipment, and photos, which threaten to overrun the bed and the television that are among Curiel's few concessions to domesticity. Curiel is always around, watching, raking the field, running the lights, keeping the kids in line. Below, on a porch that serves as a wall of fame, Curiel has posted more photos of the greatest moments in the island's baseball history. Some nights, Curiel sets up the television on the porch so the kids can gather and watch big league games, or, as happens often, a scratchy videotape of Andrew Jones's homers. With a princely gaze, Curiel surveys his domain. "To play ball, you need three things," he pronounces, touching his body as if doing the sign of the cross. "Heart, mind, balls. If you have two, you can play, but you will never be great. To be great, all three." We walk around the field. Near third base, Curiel stops to correct a small boy fielding a grounder. He speaks in a burst of Papiamento, the native language, which sounds like a reggae record played backward at high speed. Curiel is telling the boy to move in front of the ball. Like this, he demonstrates, setting down his doers, scooping an imaginary ball and firing it to an invisible base. Like this. Yes. The boy watches, nods, and does it. Behind the backstop, seated at a cement table, sit two men talking into small headsets. They are preparing the weekly radio broadcast of the game on Curaçao Radio, via a homemade setup. Next to them stands a man in a red baseball cap. His name is Fermin Coronel, and he's a scout for the St. Louis Cardinals, one of several big league scouts who live on the island. Around them sit the parents, whose casual demeanor belies their detailed knowledge of tactics and history. "Watch this boy, he has a good change-up," a 50-something mother warns me. Another man tells me of his 11-year-old son's private workouts, which include jogging 3 times a week and using dumbbells to build core strength. "It's the same workout Jurgens used," the father says, referring to Jer Jurgens, a highly regarded second-year pitcher with the Atlanta Braves, whose father, by the way, is standing just over there by the backstop. Then there are the kids. At the top of this loose hierarchy are the older teens who play junior league ball and help coach. Many of them have been to Williamsport and still wear their battered LLWS caps as badges of honor. Then come waves of increasingly younger kids, the ones for whom the LLWS is a fresh memory, the ones who return telling stories of jet flights and plasma televisions, of getting to meet major league stars and seeing themselves on ESPN. Then come the ones who are trying to make the All-Star team this year. They're the most serious of all. And finally, the loose packs of 4- and 5-year-old kids who tumble in and out of the proceedings like so many kittens, watchful and quick. Frank Curiel Field is not so much a field as a window through which these kids can see the ascending realms of heaven stacked above them in neat levels, as in a medieval painting. First comes making the league All-Star team, being one of those guys. Then comes Williamsport, in all its celebrity glory, being one of those guys. Then, just above that, is getting signed by a scout, playing in the major leagues, being one of those guys. For the kids at Frank Curiel Field, these are not gauzy dreams or glossy posters. They are tangible steps on a primal ladder of selection, distinct possibilities reflected in the crackle of the radio, the clatter of the trophies, the chrome glint off the Major League Scout sunglasses. See that house down the street? The one with a nice SUV in the driveway? That's Andrew Jones's mom's house. To be a 6-year-old at this field is, motivationally speaking, sort of like standing in the Sistine Chapel. The proof of paradise is right here. All you have to do is open your eyes. Late one evening in Curaçao, I was driving around Willemstad with Philbert Llewellyn. Like most of the adults around Curaçao Little League, Llewellyn had several jobs, coach, color announcer on the radio broadcast, and lieutenant in the police department. Around 8 p.m., Llewellyn's cell phone rang, and I assumed it was police business. In fact, it was two of his ballplayers who desperately needed him to settle an important bet about an obscure baseball rule. Llewellyn rendered his decision. No, the batter does not get credit for a sacrifice if the runner on second tags and goes to third. Hung up and smiled apologetically. "That happens a lot," he said. I have coached Little League Baseball off and on for more than a decade now, and I've received calls from players wanting to know about schedules, uniform numbers, and pizza parties, not to mention the occasional player who has a crush on my wife and wonders if maybe they can talk to her. but I've yet to get a phone call from two players arguing over the finer points of the sacrifice fly rule. They are thinking about baseball, Llewellyn said with a policeman's knowing shrug, all the time. It's going around and around inside their heads. Let's return to the question with which we began. Why did Curaçao succeed in starting a hotbed while Aruba failed? Why, given the equality of gene pool, culture, and inspirational spark, didn't Aruba ignite? Beyond the factors already noted, we should also consider the fate of their respective igniters. Sidney Ponson, the Aruban pitcher, who was such a marvelous prospect, turned out to have a drinking problem. He became overweight, bounced around to several teams, and on Christmas Day 2004 was arrested for assault and ordered to take part in 27 hours of anger management classes. Andrew Jones, on the other hand, became a 5-time All-Star and 10-time Gold Glove center fielder. The larger reason, however, is that Curaçao possessed a set of tools to keep the ignition of Jones's success lit. Curaçao grew talent because the message of Jones's success was translated and amplified into a reliable combination of primal cues. Frank Curiel Field, after all, only looks like a beat-up baseball diamond. It is, in fact, a million-watt antenna steadily transmitting a powerful stream of signals and images that add up to a thrilling whisper. Hey, that could be you. The language of ignition. Thus far, we've learned a few things about the nature of our ignition switch. First, it's either on or off. Second, it can be triggered by certain signals or primal cues. Now we'll look more deeply into how it can be triggered by the signals we use most, words. As experts in motivational psychology go, Skip Engblom does not fit the usual mold. He is a big, shambling, libertarian skate shop owner from Santa Monica, California. Engblom, you might recall, helped found the Z-Boys skateboarding team. The mumbly, mercurial, genius stoner quintessence of his personality was captured by Heath Ledger in Lords of Dogtown, the feature film about the Z-Boys. The years have left Engblom largely unchanged, except for two things. First, his once shaggy locks have been replaced by a gleaming Buddha dome. Second, he's gained new insights into his role in the Z-Boys' evolution from their random beginnings to their storied triumph at the 1975 Del Mar Skateboard Contest. Insights that resonate best if he explains them himself. Here's the setup to his story. It's the early 1970s, and a handful of sketchy-looking kids start hanging around Engblom's surf shop after school. I saw them, but I didn't say anything at first. First, I wanted to make sure they weren't shoplifting or something. But then I saw they were being cool. I let them be. Everybody else would have kicked them out, but they were okay. I grew up without a dad, and I knew their deal. They kind of reminded me of me. You know what I mean? In Engblomese, this last phrase comes out, you know what I mean? So we started spending time. It wasn't much. We went to the beach, surfed. I fed them. I saw they were really good surfers, some of these guys, so we entered this contest. So, this one Saturday, the contest comes along, and there's this guy who was supposed to be the guy. You know what I mean? He's some big-shot ringer dude who's going to turn pro or something. So I'm like the coach, right? And so I decide to put our smallest surfer, this little kid named Jay Adams, up against this pro guy in the first heat. Jay was 13. I knew Jay could do it, but Jay didn't know he could. He had no idea. So we're standing there getting ready for the contest, and people are gathered around, and they're freaking out that Jay and this guy are going to surf against each other. They're saying, whoa, no way! So that's when I go up to this big-shot pro guy, right where Jay can hear me. I tell the guy, don't worry, bud. You don't stand a chance. And Jay goes out and slaughters the guy. Jay beats the guy who was supposed to be the guy. That's when everything changed. The kids saw that and went, whoa. We started getting good at that moment. They felt it. They took that to the waves and to the street when we started that up. And Jay was the one who had the idea, you know? The one who said we should start a skateboard team. When it came to skateboards, we got all systematic about it, practiced a couple hours a day, 4 days a week. There's no instant gratification, man. Everything boils back down to training, doing it over and over. So I never said much. I would just be mellow and say, good job, dude, or nice shred, and sometimes something to up the ante, toss in a little carrot, you know, like, I heard so-and-so did that trick last week. And then they'd all be trying like crazy to do that one. You know what I mean? Because they wanted to be part of the equation. When they showed up at that contest in Del Mar, everybody made it seem like it was some big surprise. But the Z-Boys knew exactly what was going to happen. They knew because they knew exactly how good they were, because they were trained up, because they knew. Not because I told them they could, but I helped them get there, definitely. Engblom pauses, thinks deeply, and issues his wisdom. Here's the deal. You've got to give kids credit at a younger age for feeling stuff more acutely. When you say something to a kid, you've got to know what you're saying to them. The stuff you say to a kid starting out, you've got to be super careful. You know what I mean? What skill building really is confidence building. First, they got to earn it. Then they got it. And once it gets lit, it stays lit pretty good. On one level, Engblom didn't do all that much. His communications with the team consisted of a few mumbled phrases. Some of them set up a highly specific challenge at key moments. Don't worry, bro. You don't have a chance. I heard so-and-so did that trick last week. Others encouraged their efforts. Good job, dude. Nice shred. And yet without Engblom, without his verbal signals and his guidance, the Z-Boys might never have happened, much less succeeded. It's as if those few offhand phrases, small as they were, somehow helped ignite them to new levels of motivation and effort. And according to theories developed by Dr. Carol Dweck, Engblom's verbal cues, however minimal, are just the kind to send the right signal. Dweck is a social psychologist at Stanford who has spent the last 30 years studying motivation. She's carved an impressively varied path across the field, starting with animal motivation and shifting to more complex creatures, chiefly elementary and high school students. Some of her most eye-opening research involves the relationship between motivation and language. Left to our own devices, we go along in a pretty stable mindset, she said, but when we get a clear cue, a message that sends a spark, then boing, we respond. The boing phenomenon can be seen most vividly in a series of experiments Dweck did with 400 New York fifth graders. The study was a scientific version of the fable The Princess and the Pea. Its goal was to see how much a tiny signal, a single sentence of praise, can affect performance and effort, and what kind of signal is most effective. First, Dweck gave every child a test that consisted of fairly easy puzzles. Afterward, the researcher informed all the children of their scores, adding a single six-word sentence of praise. Half of the kids were praised for their intelligence. You must be smart at this. And half were praised for their effort. You must have worked really hard. The kids were tested a second time, but this time they were offered a choice between a harder test and an easier test. 90% of the kids who'd been praised for their effort chose the harder test. The majority of the kids who'd been praised for their intelligence, on the other hand, chose the easy test. Why? When we praise children for their intelligence, Dweck wrote, we tell them that's the name of the game. Look smart. Don't risk making mistakes. The third level of tests was uniformly harder. None of the kids did well. However, the two groups of kids, the praised for effort group and the praised for intelligence group, responded very differently to the situation. The effort group dug in and grew very involved with the test, trying solutions, testing strategies, Dweck said. They later said they liked it, but the group praised for its intelligence hated the harder test. They took it as proof they weren't smart. The experiment then came full circle, returning to a test of the same difficulty as the initial test. The praised for effort group improved their initial score by 30%, while the praised for intelligence group score declined by 20%. All because of six short words. Dweck was so surprised at the result that she reran the study five times. Each time the result was the same. We are exquisitely attuned to messages telling us what is valued, Dweck said. I think we go around all the time looking, trying to understand. Who am I in this setting? Who am I in this framework? So that when a clear message comes, it can send a spark. True to the findings of Dweck's study, each of the hotbeds I visited used language that affirmed the value of effort and slow progress rather than innate talent or intelligence. At Spartak, for instance, they did not play tennis. They preferred the verb baratsiya, fight or struggle. South Korean golfers are exhorted to yonsope, which translates to Nike's possible delight as just do it. In Curaçao, the 9 to 10-year-olds play in the Liga Vreminga, the Little Ant League. The watchword is progressa, baby steps. In Brazilian soccer, the age levels are the bottle, 5 and 6-year-olds, diapers, 7 and 8, and pacifier, 9 and 10. The under-20 national team is called the Aspirantes, the hopeful ones. The English call their youth team the Reserves, Emilio Miranda told me, chortling. What are they reserved for? At all the places I visited, praise was not constant, but was given only when it was earned, a finding that dovetails with the research of Dweck, who notes that motivation does not increase with increased levels of praise, but often dips. Remember, our study showed the effect that just 6 words can have, Dweck said. It's all about clarity. When we use the term motivational language, we're generally referring to language that speaks of hopes, dreams, and affirmations. You are the best! This kind of language, let's call it high motivation, has its role. But the message from Dweck and the Hotbeds is clear. High motivation is not the kind of language that ignites people. What works is precisely the opposite. Not reaching up, but reaching down, speaking to the ground-level effort, affirming the struggle. Dweck's research shows that phrases like, "Wow, you really tried hard," or "Good job, dude," motivate far better than what she calls empty praise. From the Myelin point of view, this conclusion makes sense. Praising effort works because it reflects biological reality. The truth is, skill circuits are not easy to build. Deep practice requires serious effort and passionate work. The truth is, when you're starting out, you do not play tennis. You struggle and fight and pay attention and slowly get better. The truth is, we learn in staggering baby steps. Effort-based language works because it speaks directly to the core of the learning experience. And when it comes to ignition, there's nothing more powerful. If I was at college, my success rate would be pretty good, you know what I mean? Engblom said. I mean, 80 or 85% of my guys end up successful businessmen, athletes, millionaires. You can't say that about Harvard. Chapter 7. How to Ignite a Hotbed. Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire. W.B. Yeats. Mike and Dave's Ridiculous Idea. Talent hotbeds like Curaçao, Russia, and South Korea were ignited by a lightning strike, a breakthrough star, a magical victory. No one could have predicted or planned them. A different kind of ignition occurs when there's no lightning strike, and yet motivation and talent bloom anyway. This is the kind of ignition that relates more directly to our daily lives. And I found it happening most vividly in an unexpected place, a group of inner-city schools. In the winter of 1993, Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin were not doing well. They were in their early 20s, roommates and second-year teachers in the Houston public school system. Both were members of Teach for America, a fledgling nonprofit group through which recent college graduates taught for 2 years in low-income schools. Feinberg and Levin's first year had been rocky, slashed tires, chaotic classes. Their second year, slightly worse. They'd tried to innovate, but had found their efforts blocked by incompetent bureaucracy, unhelpful parents, misbehaving students, hidebound regulations, and the other blunt cogs of the most efficient frustration machine ever invented, the American inner-city public school system. Levin had been asked not to return to his school. Feinberg, reaching an even deeper depth, found himself wishfully contemplating law school. So they spent their winter evenings sitting around their crummy Houston apartment, engaging in the time-honored activity of 20-somethings everywhere, bitching about work, drinking beer, and watching Star Trek. Their mindset was later summed up by Feinberg. Life sucks, and then you die. One night, during that long winter, for reasons that remain mysterious, an inspiring speech they'd attended, they think, or maybe it was the beer, these two failed Gen Xers suddenly had a perverse idea. they would stop fighting the system and start their own school. They put on a pot of coffee, set the stereo to play Achtung Baby by U2 on repeat, and by 5 a.m. they had printed a manifesto containing the four pillars of their creation: more classroom time, quality teachers, parental support, and administrative support. The caffeine must have kicked in, because the two baptized their project with a name that was as grandiose as anything Captain Kirk could dream up. They called it the Knowledge is Power Program, or KIPP. At any other moment in history, an idea as vague as KIPP, supported by little but inexperience, would have evaporated. But as it happened, Texas had recently passed laws funding charter schools, provided they achieved baseline educational standards. This resulted a few months later in a situation that would have previously been unthinkable. These two newbies and their coffee-stained manifesto would get their shot. Not a whole school, the Board of Education wasn't that crazy, but a single room in the corner of Garcia Elementary, where Feinberg and Levin would be free to take the next inevitable step on their idealistic journey, fall on their faces. The majority of charter schools are built on a foundation of educational theory, such as Waldorf, Montessori, or Piaget. Feinberg and Levin, short on time, instead followed the principles of Butch Cassidy. They stole. They located their district's best teachers and nabbed lesson plans, teaching techniques, management ideas, schedules, rules, everything. Feinberg and Levin would later be called innovative, but at the time they were about as innovative as a shoplifter during a blackout. "We took every good idea that wasn't nailed down," Feinberg said. "We took everything but the kitchen sink. And then we went back and took the kitchen sink, too." From this pile of stolen parts, they assembled an educational jalopy. It featured an engine of old-fashioned hard work, longer school days, shorter summer vacations, uniforms, a clear system of punishment and reward, encased in a skin of innovative techniques. Timetables would be learned via rapping. Kids would be given teachers' home phone numbers for homework questions. On the wall, Feinberg and Levin pasted a slogan pilfered from a renowned Los Angeles teacher named Rafe Esquith: "Work hard, be nice," and pointed their jalopy toward a distant goal, to do whatever it took to get the students into college. "It was clear to us from the start that college is really the key of the whole thing," Feinberg said. "When you get out there in the public school system of big cities, you realize how screwed up it is, how the zip code you're born in basically determines your chance of failing or succeeding. College is the door out." That spring and summer, Feinberg and Levin set about recruiting subjects for their experiment. After an intensive neighborhood campaign, they wound up with 50 students, most of whose parents were just as frustrated with the status quo as Feinberg and Levin were. When KIPP's first class walked into the tiny room for their first day, college seemed a long way off. The students ranked well below average in ability. Only 53% had passed the state English and math tests the previous year. The room was overcrowded. Their host school put up a steady resistance to their presence. The longer school days, 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., plus classes every other Saturday per the manifesto, put a strain on everyone. But then something strange happened. It was impossible to put a finger on it, but at some point that autumn the jalopy coughed, sputtered, and started moving. To the amazement of everyone, not least Feinberg and Levin, the KIPP students lived up to their slogan. They were nice, and they worked hard, extremely hard. At the end of the first year, 90% of the students passed the state exams. Encouraged, Feinberg and Levin kept going. For the first years, they taught like nomads. Feinberg stayed in Houston while Levin relocated to the Bronx. They fought for space, taught in trailers, and cadged unused rooms. Each year they stole more good ideas and tossed out the ones that failed. And each year KIPP's test scores kept rising. By 1999, the KIPP academies in Houston and the Bronx were scoring higher on standardized tests than any other public schools in their respective districts. The jalopy wasn't just picking up speed. It was lapping the field. Word spread. After a 60 Minutes report, KIPP received a $15 million donation from Donald and Doris Fisher, founders of the Gap clothing store. Dozens, then hundreds of young teachers, many of them from the Teach for America program, which has subsequently become highly successful, placing 2,900 new teachers each year and attracting applicants from 10% of Georgetown's, Yale's, and Harvard's 2008 graduating classes, signed on to start their own KIPP schools. By 2008, there were 66 KIPP schools from Los Angeles to New York, serving 16,000 students. Many KIPP schools now produce students who achieve some of the highest scores in their respective cities. And most crucially, 80% of KIPP students go on to attend college. Feinberg and Levin still teach fifth graders in Houston and the Bronx, in addition to overseeing the KIPP schools in their areas and working on KIPP's National Board of Directors. Jason Snipes, a member of Harvard University's Council of Great City Schools, sums up their success in Andrew Jones' terms. KIPP is really knocking it out of the park. One way to look at KIPP is as a unique tale of good-hearted underdogs who caught lightning in a bottle. If that were all it was, our interest in the story would end now. The other way to look at it, however, is as an example of pure ignition, the art and science of creating a talent hotbed from the ground up without the assistance of a World Series homer or any other magical breakthrough. That's why it's useful to look under the hood of this remarkable jalopy to see what makes it go. Curtain up. At most schools, the first day of a new academic year is likened to the first few strides of a marathon run, or perhaps the first skirmish of an insurgent war. At KIPP schools like KIPP Hartwood Academy in San Jose, California, however, the first day is like opening night for a Broadway play. There are scripts, timed entrances and plot lines, a nervous audience, and 10 minutes before curtain, a backstage pre-show huddle. At KIPP Hartwood, that teacher's huddle takes place in an empty classroom a few steps from the outdoor courtyard where the students are beginning to assemble. "Okay, people, let's be quick and sharp out there," says Seba Ali, the school leader, to her staff of 15 teachers. "We'll clap them in, do the welcome, the college talk, introduce each teacher, then do the be nice talk at the end. Everybody got it?" Seba Ali is 31 years old and 5 feet tall. She's wearing a sleek beige pantsuit and softly clicking high heels, and she carries herself with a silken but unmistakable authority, a hybrid of Audrey Hepburn and Erwin Rommel. Ali has no earthly need to repeat this information. It's all neatly typed on the script for the day, which accounts for every event, transition, and activity. For the past few days, the staff has been reviewing the script in detail. They spent, for instance, a full hour discussing the correct body spacing and foot placement for KIPP fifth graders standing in a straight line. By now, this day has been rehearsed and practiced to a nit, as Ali puts it. In the courtyard, milling in the early morning sunshine, stand the 140 new KIPP students and their families. The kids are jumpy. The parents smother their own nervousness with reassuring smiles and hugs. They are mostly Hispanic, with a handful of Asians and African Americans. They come from San Jose's boundless sea of low-rent bungalows and government-subsidized apartments. Like many KIPP schools, this one began small, with Ali's door-to-door neighborhood campaign in 2004 as she asked parents about their experiences in the public school and inquired if they might be interested in an alternative. Around the neighborhood, Ali was known as the lady who asks a lot of questions. The first year, KIPP had 75 fifth graders. Since then, they've added 275 more students and 3 additional grade levels, and now they have a fast-growing waiting list. All of which helps account for the atmosphere of poignant excitement here in the courtyard. The air is filled with a sense of irrevocable departure, as if the kids are boarding an ocean liner bound for a new world. While the vast majority of KIPP Hartwood students come from the local school district, not all of them do. Letha Narayanan had driven her son an hour from their home in Fremont, California. Narayanan, who had a well-paying job with an internet consulting firm, said the public schools in her neighborhood were high quality. She had come to KIPP, however, because she wanted to make 100% sure that her son, Ajit, would go on to attend college. "I heard about what they do here," she said. "I said, I want this for my child." At precisely 8 a.m., Ali and the rest of the teachers walk to the courtyard. Ali claps 5 times. The other teachers join in, counting them out. The kids fall silent. The parents instinctively fall away. "Good morning," Ali says loudly. The kids murmur. "Good morning," Ali repeats. "Good morning," a few say. Ali tilts her head, disappointed, expectant. "Good morning," she tries again. Another teacher, Lolita Jackson, offers the right response. "Good morning, Ms. Ali." This time they get it. The next time